Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, December 15th, 2022. The Senate moves to pass a one-week extension of temporary federal government spending to avoid a government shutdown as the outline of a longer government spending bill is being put together for Senate and House floor action next week. U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington wrapping up. We'll talk with White House correspondent for USA Today, Joey Garrison, about what President Biden hoped to accomplish and if he succeeded. Russia issues a threat of unpredictable consequences if the U.S. sends Patriot anti-missile systems to Ukraine. We'll get the Pentagon reaction. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha announces free at-home rapid tests through the mail to all U.S. households is returning after a three-month hiatus ahead of a potential winter surge of coronavirus cases. U.S. House passing a bill that would have residents of the current U.S. territory of Puerto Rico vote on a binding referendum for a new political status, choosing from U.S. statehood, independence, or independence followed by free association with the United States. Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez, Democrat from New York, who was born and raised in Puerto Rico, saying, "We are here today because we must move toward decolonialization." And we start with an update on federal government spending. The House Wednesday night passed a one-week extension, called a CR, or continuing resolution, by a vote of 224 to 201. Nine House Republicans joining Democrats in voting yes, then sending it over to the Senate. And this morning, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urging quick passage of the CR as work on the larger spending bill continues.
Last night, the House of Representatives passed a one-week continuing resolution that will keep the government open long enough for us to pass a bipartisan year-long omnibus. Negotiations keep trending in the right direction, but we still have a lot of work left to do and not enough time to do it unless we extend government funding for another week. Let me put it a different way. As of this morning, the Senate will now require consent from both parties if we want to pass a CR before funding runs out tomorrow at midnight. We should move quickly to avert a shutdown today, without any unwelcome brouhaha that has caused shutdowns in years past. Democrats are ready to act at a moment's notice, and I hope Republicans will stand ready too. Both sides are going to spend the day working on an agreement to get the week-long CR done. We should have no drama, no gridlock, and no delay on passing a week-long CR. Just remember, those who demand something happen and risk shutting down the government almost always lose.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor. Passage in the Senate of the one-week extension of temporary government funding, the CR, and then having President Biden sign it into law would move the new deadline to next Friday, December 23rd. But the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying this week that Senate Republicans want the full fiscal year funding bill being finalized, the omnibus spending bill, to pass by Thursday, December 22nd.
Our side has made it clear that the Senate has until December the 22nd to complete either a full-year funding bill or a short-term CR into early next year. That's the deadline, and those are the two options. If a truly bipartisan full-year bill without poison pills is ready for final Senate passage by late next week, then I'll support it, for our armed forces particularly. Otherwise, we'll be passing a short-term continuing resolution into the new year.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor on Wednesday. That option of a short-term CR into the new year is one favored by the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, who is running for Speaker of the House in the next Congress when the Republicans will be in the majority. Some Democrats advocating for passing a full fiscal year continuing resolution, continuing to fund programs at current levels through October of 2023, if the omnibus spending bill being negotiated is not able to pass. On the House floor today, an update from the Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, about what the schedule looks like in the House next week as lawmakers look to keep the government open and get home before Christmas.
Based upon the present information on the Senate timeline for passing the omnibus, the earliest the House is expected to meet is Wednesday with votes at 6:30. That's the earliest, with the votes of the week postponed until 6:30 p.m. The House is also expected to meet on Thursday, December 22nd, and will stay in session until the omnibus is completed. If the Senate acts on the omnibus earlier in the week, members will be given 24 hours, not the normal 72 hours, 24 hours notice to return to D.C. Members should expect the House will be in session for at least two legislative days next week. The House will consider bills under suspension of the rules and additional legislative items as possible. As a result, we all understand Christmas is Sunday, and none of us want to be here. But all of us have a responsibility, obviously, to complete the business of funding the government of the United States of America. So we will be here. But we will not be here unless the Senate acts more quickly than we anticipate before Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. will be the first votes. If it's later than that, you will also get notice. If it's earlier than that, you'll get notice.
The House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer on the House floor today. And an update on the other large bill making its way through Congress, the Defense Authorization, the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act. C-SPAN's Craig Kaplan tweeting that the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has locked in a time agreement by unanimous consent for the Senate to vote on amendments and final passage of the NDAA tonight, Thursday. CNN reports President Joe Biden hailed cooperation with Africa and said he looked forward to visiting the continent soon as he endeavors to expand ties in a region where China and Russia have been making inroads. Speaking at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, the president announced billions of dollars in new commitments on financing and bolstering democracy and affirmed he supported a permanent seat for the African Union at the Group of 20. That from CNN, one of today's sessions held at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center.
Over the next 3 years, working in close cooperation with the United States Congress, we plan to commit $55 billion in Africa to advance the priorities we share and to support the Agenda 2063. That number represents a comprehensive commitment from the United States to invest in Africa's people, Africa's infrastructure, Africa's agriculture, Africa's health system, Africa's security, and more. In our view, our new shared vision statement lays out a forward-looking foundation for the 21st century partnership between Africa and the United States. We want to work with you on these issues that matter most to our people's lives, and we're looking to increase our collaboration in every area, from rural communities to urban centers to cyberspace to outer space. In addition to our investments, we're also committed to helping African countries assess the financing you need to build sustainable and inclusive economies. We're leading a global effort to pursue equitable arrangements for global creditors to provide debt relief so nations can prioritize their people, not backbreaking debt payments. And I'm asking the Congress for the authority to lend $21 billion to the International Monetary Fund to provide access to necessary financing for low and middle income countries that are so difficult to come by now, and will help Africa's recovery efforts and support projects that build resilience against future crises. As we engage with your countries, the United States will always lead with our values. Support for democracy, respect for the rule of law, commitment to human rights, responsible government, all are part of our DNA. That doesn't mean we always get everything right. We surely don't. And the work of democracy is never finished or never guaranteed. It's about consistent and constant self-improvement. But that's why democracy is the best tool we have to address the wide range of challenges we all face. And that belief is shared by Africans and Americans alike.
With more on President Biden's hosting the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit this week in Washington, we're joined on the phone by Joey Garrison, White House correspondent for USA Today. Thank you very much. Nearly 50 heads of state from African countries, nearly the entire continent. What have been the goals of this summit, and have they been accomplished?
Well, it's a pretty big deal. As you recall, or you might recall, during the Trump administration, there wasn't a U.S. Africa summit, and the last one that there has been hosted by the U.S. was under Obama in 2014. So it's been a long time since these nations have come to the United States. And from the Biden perspective, you know, this is coming. This meeting, which wrapped up today on Thursday, you know, came as amid growing influence from two other superpowers, China and Russia, in Africa. And, you know, what we've seen, you know, in terms of that front is China surpassed U.S. In foreign investment in the continent of Africa. And several African nations have been reluctant to follow the U.S.'s lead to condemn Russia's war in Ukraine. So really, with that as the current, you know, backdrop and following the Trump administration, the U.S., the Biden administration has really worked to re-strengthen ties with many of these African nations.
Which African countries were not invited, and why?
Well, there were five, and I don't have the full list in front of me. But basically, there had been recent coups, other acts of not necessarily going down a democratic path. And so, the other 49 out of 55 African nations, or 50 out of 55. Have been present for these last 3 days. And really the big announcement, the biggest, came today from President Biden when he committed to soon visit Africa. And that would be the first presidential visit to that continent since Obama in 2013. You know, there's been a president, Trump was the first president since Ronald Reagan not to make a trip to Africa. So that'll be a big deal. We think it'll probably be in 2013, though the president nor the White House was neither said for sure exactly when it come, nor which nations he will visit. But, you know, Biden also committed the First Lady, as well as Vice President Harris, Secretary of State Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and others will all be part of a major U.S. delegation going to Africa. And what I expect will be a multi-day, a multi-nation trip.
We're talking with Joey Garrison from USA Today. How much does U.S. domestic politics play into this when it comes to the African-American community? There have been a couple of references by the president and vice president and secretary of state over the past couple of days.
Well, you know, I do think, you know, in terms of this was a president whose, you know, political standing in the White House, who was elected as president, thanks in large part to strong support from the African-American community here in the United States. He also has Kamala Harris, the first African-American vice president. So, I mean, I think that is part of kind of the central message to Africa, or rather to these nations that make up Africa, in terms of, again, as I alluded to earlier, strengthening ties and really showing that the United States recognizes Africa as a geopolitical force. I mean, I think a lot of these I think a lot of these African nations have felt, you know, they get lip service about, you know, the United States wanting to commit aid, et cetera, to Africa, but then they don't see a follow through. And so one of the major points that Biden made today was he's appointed Johnny Carson. That's Johnny, not the former talk show host, but rather former U.S. ambassador to Kenya, to oversee the actions that came out of this summit. In addition to that, President Biden has committed $55 billion in aid over the next 3 years to help with many issues that are front and center there. So, you know, I think going back to your original question, I mean, I think the president has tried to use his strong political ties with the African-American community in the United States to give more credibility to his promises overseas to the African people.
It's been a three-day summit, a lot of different events, many of them highly scripted. Have there been any surprise moments?
Well, I don't know if there's been any major surprise so far. I mean, these events are fairly scripted. And so, you know, you had one event yesterday that was on trade and infrastructure issues. And then even when it came to President Biden's major announcements, we kind of knew that they were going to be made. And another one today was urging or endorsing the inclusion of the African Union, which consists of 55 African nations, to be joining the G20, which, of course, is the group of nations that represents the largest economies in the world. And that's something that many African nations have been striving for, and getting the president's endorsement on that, you know, is a big deal. Right now, South Africa is the only nation in Africa that has representation there. So, you know, I wouldn't say there's been a big shocker from this event here. But, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily what the administration was going for. It's a highly choreographed, orchestrated trip. And you know, I think they have accomplished many of the goals they sought.
Joey Garrison is White House correspondent with USA Today. His story is at usatoday.com and on Twitter at Joey Garrison. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And more from the summit this week, President Biden hosting the African leaders at a White House dinner Wednesday night.
Our people lie at the heart of the deep and profound connection that forever binds Africa and the United States together. We remember the stolen men and women and children were brought to our shores in chains, subjected to unimaginable cruelty. My nation's original sin was that period. We honor their descendants who for generations helped build this country and propel it to higher heights, leading the charge, blazing new trails, and forging a better future for everyone in America. We celebrate an African diaspora community in the United States, millions strong, pulling America and the United States together in a tight embrace of family.
President Biden Wednesday night giving the toast at a dinner honoring the visiting leaders from the African nations as the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit wraps up today in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Senate late on Wednesday, writes Reuters, passed by voice vote a bill to bar federal employees from using Chinese-owned short video sharing app TikTok on government-owned devices. The vote is the latest action on the part of U.S. lawmakers to crack down on Chinese companies amid national security fears that Beijing could use them to spy on Americans. And the move comes as state governments, especially those led by Republicans, have taken steps to limit the use of the app on state-owned devices. That reporting from Reuters. The bill sponsor, Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, spoke on the Senate floor today about last night's vote.
The most downloaded app in the world for the last 2 and 3 years running. Back in 2020, over 100 million Americans, 100 million, used TikTok, and that was over 2 years ago. Since 2022, TikTok's average monthly users, and this year, every quarter of this year, has increased by 234%. It's incredible growth. And you can see why. It's a fun app to use. Here's what most Americans don't know, because TikTok doesn't want them to know, is that the app runs continuously in the background on your phone or device. It collects your keystrokes. It has access to your email, access to your calendars, access to the notes and clipboard functions, of your computer or iPhone or tablet or device. It, of course, tracks your geolocation. It is essentially an evidence-gathering, data-gathering machine that runs on your phone. Can you turn it off? Can you stop it from doing these things? No, you can't. Not if you want to use the app. And what's the connection to Beijing? Only this, that TikTok is owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company, and under Chinese law, that company must provide all data to the Chinese Communist Party that the party wants upon its request. And we know that there are Chinese Communist Party members in TikTok leadership. We know that the Chinese Communist Party has held so-called training sessions for ByteDance and TikTok employees. We know that this data, Americans' data, is available to the Chinese Communist Party, to Beijing, because of TikTok. And it is time we did something to protect American users. We've been warned repeatedly by our own intelligence agencies that TikTok is a security threat. Heck, the director of the FBI has testified under oath that TikTok poses major security risks. That's why the Pentagon, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, TSA, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, and the Marine Corps have all already banned the use of TikTok on government devices. The only sensible next step is for this Congress to act to make that ban across the board for all federal devices.
Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, on the Senate floor today talking about passage Wednesday night of his bill that would do what he said, banning TikTok on government devices. The Senate passing it by unanimous consent, meaning no senator objected, sending it over to the House. And today at the White House briefing with Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, she was asked about the Biden administration's position.
I'm wondering if the White House has any reaction on two bills that moved through the U.S. Senate. One is on TikTok. The Senate voted to ban TikTok from all government-issued phones. Let's start with that one. Does the White House have feelings on that bill?
So, as I've said before, want to be very careful on commenting on any specific legislation at this time. So, we'd refer you to Congress on the next steps. We don't get involved in the process as we've done in the past. But look. Just more broadly, there are a range of tech applications and products that are not allowed to be used on the White House and other federal government work equipment for security reasons, including TikTok. We will not go into any further details about security policies that we have here, but I'm not going to get into the process. I know that this just happened, so we're going to let Congress move forward with their process on
position on that one. What about the Senate bill that would essentially halt Huawei's access to U.S. banks? The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is one of the sponsors of that bill. Does the White House have a position on that one?
No, don't have a position on that one at this time from here.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her briefing with reporters. The Biden administration today also adding over 20 Chinese artificial intelligence computer chip companies to a trade blacklist, including WMTC, over concerns the company could send U.S. technology to previously blacklisted Chinese tech giants, including Huawei. Russia's foreign ministry warning that if the United States confirms reports that it plans to send Patriot surface-to-air defense missile systems to Ukraine, it would mean, quote, the U.S. has effectively become a party to the war, and it could lead to, quote, unpredictable consequences. The White House, State Department, and Pentagon so far have not confirmed the media reports, which have been citing unnamed government officials as sources. Questions about this in general and the Russian warning today to the Pentagon Press Secretary, Pat Ryder.
Russia today warned of unpredictable consequences if the U.S. does indeed provide Ukraine a Patriot missile defense system. What's the status of deliberations on whether or not to provide Ukraine the Patriot, and does Russia's reaction influence the U.S. decision-making process at all on this?
So just to clarify, you're referring to Russian officials who have said that if we provide Patriots, that would be provocative?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, I don't have any announcements to make today regarding any new security assistance packages. As always, we will continue to remain committed to providing Ukraine with the key capabilities that it needs to defend its nation. On the latter part there about the comments, I would just say that I find it ironic and very telling that officials from a country that brutally attacked its neighbor in an illegal and unprovoked invasion through a campaign that is deliberately targeting and killing innocent civilians and destroying civilian infrastructure, that they would choose to use words like provocative to describe defensive systems that are meant to save lives and protect civilians. And so despite Russia's propaganda to portray themselves as victims, it's important to remember that Russia is the aggressor here. And when it comes to escalation, they could de-escalate the situation today by withdrawing their forces and saving countless innocent lives. But clearly they've chosen to double down. And the last thing I would say is the U.S. is not at war with Russia, and we do not seek conflict. Our focus is on providing Ukraine with the security assistance that it needs to defend itself. And that's something we said we would do well before Russia chose to invade, and something we will continue to do for as long as it takes.
So their reactions today are not going to weigh on the calculation of whether to send a Patriot or not?
We're not going to allow comments from Russia to dictate the security assistance that we provide to Ukraine. Thank you.
Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder and Air Force Brigadier General with reporters today in the Pentagon briefing room. Associated Press writing, operating and maintaining a Patriot battery requires as many as 90 troops, and for months the U.S. has been reluctant to provide the complex system because sending American forces into Ukraine to operate the systems is a non-starter for the administration of President Joe Biden. Even without the presence of U.S. service members to train Ukrainians on use of the system, concerns remain that deployment of the missiles could provoke Russia or risk that a fired projectile could hit inside Russia and further escalate the conflict. That reporting from Associated Press. Washington Today continues in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. The Biden administration again making COVID-19 tests available for free home delivery. This after a three-month pause as health officials look to another possible surge of coronavirus cases this winter. The weekly case count, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, is now over 400,000. And only about 13.5% of Americans have gotten the updated vaccine booster shot. Each household will be able to get 4 rapid coronavirus tests. You can get them through the website covidtests.gov. Dr. Ashish Shah, White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator, giving details at the White House briefing today.
Today we're opening up covidtests.gov for a limited time this winter to give Americans another easy option to access testing when there is a greater need, as there is right now. Starting today, each U.S. household can order up to 4 at-home tests free from covidtests.gov, with tests starting to ship as early as next week, the week of December 19th. And as we've said for months, we're operating in a resource-constrained environment in the absence of additional congressional funding for the nation's COVID response. And that means we've had to make some tough choices. Like in the summer, we were forced to suspend the covidtests.gov program so we could preserve our tests. Why did we want to preserve our tests? Because we knew there would be a moment later in the year when COVID cases would rise again. So we preserved the tests so we could have them on hand for exactly this moment. And if we don't get more funding, we won't be able to send more tests out to the American people.
Dr. Ashish Jha, White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator, with reporters today at the White House. He again urged all Americans to get that updated COVID-19 vaccine booster. 2 reports today from the House Intelligence Committee about COVID, one from the Democrats and one from the Republicans. On the Democratic side, the committee chair, Adam Schiff of California, writes, in 2020, the intelligence community was not well positioned or prepared to provide early warning and unique insights on the pandemic. And he writes, the intelligence community must improve its performance in analyzing vast volumes of data to spot unusual trends in health activity indicative of a disease that is either undetected by or concealed by public health authorities. The Republicans on the Intelligence Committee putting out a report that has this. Contrary to the implication of the intelligence community's declassified report, based on our investigation involving a variety of public and non-public information, we conclude that there are indications that SARS-CoV-2 may have been tied to China's biological weapons research program and spilled over to the human population during a lab-related incident at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Of course, with the new Congress, the Republicans will be in the majority, and they will be chairing that committee and all committees in the House. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 764 points, NASDAQ down 360, S&P down 99. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Rohit Chopra testified today before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, part of his semi-annual report to Congress. Senator Steve Daines, Republican from Montana, asking the director about a new rule that includes discrimination in the definition of unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts and practices in the consumer finance industry that the CFPB can take action on.
In late September, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit challenging the legality of CFPB's changes to the Unfair, Deceptive, or Abusive Acts or Practices UDAP exam manual. While lawmakers such as myself and many here expect the CFPB to enforce legislation that protects consumers against discrimination, it seems as though the Bureau has unilaterally decided, without congressional oversight, that UDAP now includes disparate impact liability. In the 12 years since Dodd-Frank was enacted, neither Congress nor the CFPB has claimed that the legislation authorizes disparate impact under UDAP. Unfortunately, instead of implementing these changes in an open and very transparent rulemaking process, your Bureau simply issued a press release announcing a very controversial change. Back in 18, the CFPB disparate impact guidance for auto lending was overturned by Congress after the Bureau's enforcement methodologies were found to be flawed and, importantly, not authorized by statute. Now it appears as if your Bureau is attempting to implement disparate impact guidance, not just for lenders, but for all consumer financial products and services, and we're hearing a lot about that. Putting aside whether this tactic is legal or not, which I do not believe it is, do you think the CFPB's implementation of disparate impact guidance through a press release without congressional authorization or a notice and comment rulemaking is a transparent way to make policy changes?
So I appreciate the question, Senator Daines. So this is not a disparate impact. Senator Toomey has claimed this many times, and it's just not true. I'm happy to talk you through the legal details of it, but I want to answer the question you've really posed at the end, which is about transparency. One of the things that Senator Toomey and others have really expressed is that they worry about regulation by enforcement. The sense that firms should know what's obligated of them under existing law. So one of the things we've done is we've tried our best to find lots of different ways to issue guidance that doesn't have the force of law, but it gives entities a sense of what does the current law require. In the case you mentioned of the exam manual, that's really also about consistent examination. The manual is guidance for examiners that when they are investigating potential discriminatory or other unlawful conduct, how might it implicate some of the existing laws that Congress has authorized and prohibited? In many situations, illegal conduct can violate multiple laws, but I want to figure out, and I'm happy to work with you to figure out, what is the way to be transparent, but also, you know, how to best.
I'm way over time. One last sentence. I appreciate expressing interest in supporting community banks, smaller banks, and competition. I think it's important you get the feedback early in that rulemaking process from all entities, including these smaller banks, community banks. Thank you.
Senator Steve Daines, Republican from Montana, questioning the Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Rohit Chopra, at today's Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee hearing. We covered the hearing on C-SPAN, and the full video is available at cspan.org. When the CFPB released the guidance that was just discussed, it included a blog post that said, depending on how the conduct occurs, face-to-face, digital, systematic, etc., many individuals may be unaware they received disparate treatment or a discriminatory outcome. The U.S. House today passed a bill dealing with the status of Puerto Rico, which, writes the New York Times, will allow Puerto Ricans to decide the political future of the territory, the first time the chamber has committed to backing a binding process that could pave the way for Puerto Rico to become the nation's 51st state or an independent country. Article goes on, the legislation would establish a binding process for a referendum in Puerto Rico that would allow voters to choose among allowing the territory to become a state, independent country, or sovereign government aligned with the United States. It would also lay out the processes for implementing the outcome of the vote and establish a campaign to educate voters about their options. Here's part of the floor debate. One supporter, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York.
Today represents a historic moment. While Puerto Rico is not the United States' only colony, it is its oldest. Today, for the first time in our nation's history, the United States will acknowledge its role as a colonizing force and Puerto Rico's status as an extended colony. The Puerto Rico Status Act begins a process for Boricuas to decide their own future. And in this bill, we have made historic and unprecedented gains. Never before have terms for independence and free association been so clearly defined, including ramifications for citizenship. This bill excludes the current unsustainable colonial status. It clarifies that U.S. birthright citizenship and transmission of citizenship remains the same in any event of status selection. It provides 10 years of compensatory finance in the event of free association. And it also includes an agreement to international election observers over the course of a plebiscite. This bill has also achieved historic and unprecedented multi-party agreement on the island, including representatives from the Independence, Statehood, and Movimiento Victoria parties. These gains are critically important to codify in precedent here in this House.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, today on the House floor. Speaking in opposition to this bill, Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican from California.
Completely ignored is the right of all the American people to discuss and decide so momentous and irreversible a question as this. Statehood would mean that the next reapportionment, other states will lose a total of 4 seats in the House of Representatives in order to accommodate the Puerto Rican delegation. Only about 20% of the population is fluent in English, which means that we would be admitting a state whose vast majority is isolated from the national political debate that is central to our democracy. Nor will statehood solve Puerto Rico's economic problems. Residents would now have to pay all federal income taxes from which they're currently exempt. The GAO estimates that would cost Puerto Rico 70% of its existing manufacturing base. And there's not even a CBO estimate of the cost to American taxpayers of admitting a chronically mismanaged and utterly bankrupt state government. The economy of Puerto Rico is expected to underperform the national economy, which is itself a disaster. For American taxpayers, it would mean a new state that has the lowest per capita income in the country and the largest per capita debt. Its labor participation rate is 40% compared to 62% nationally. 43% of the population lives below the poverty line. Its academic performance would be the worst in the nation. So, how does it benefit America to admit a state that will be the most indebted, uneducated, poorest, and least employed state in the nation? And we don't get to consider that question because under this bill, Congress gets no further say in the matter once Puerto Rico has voted. That makes it a blanket abrogation of the responsibility of Congress to make these decisions in the best interests of all of the people of the United States.
Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican from California, today on the House floor. The House passed this bill by a vote of 233 to 191, voting yes, 217 Democrats and 16 Republicans. Also speaking on the floor, by the way, is the only current member of Congress from Puerto Rico, known as the resident commissioner, a non-voting delegate, the office now held by Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, a Republican. She said she favors the bill and personally favors statehood for Puerto Rico, and she noted that she can talk about the bill, but she cannot vote for it. More from the New York Times article on this. Puerto Rico has held six plebiscites on whether it should become a state, most recently in 2020, when 52% of the voters on the island endorsed the move. None of the plebiscites has been binding, however, and turnout has often been low amid boycotts by critics who support the status quo or independence. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, holding her weekly briefing today, and she says it could be her last as Speaker, depending upon what happens with the House schedule. She did not run again for House Democratic Caucus leadership in the next Congress, which starts in January. She was asked about her legacy today, 20 years leading the House Democrats, 8 as House Speaker in 2 4-year blocks.
You said this could be one of the last press conferences that we have with you as
Speaker.
Be.
And we may have one a day.
Unless we're until Christmas. But if you just can look back on your decades in leadership, how do you want your legacy, your time serving in leadership to be remembered?
Well, that's a whole subject. Perhaps I'll close with that, but nothing in any of the years that I was there compares to the Affordable Care Act, expanding health care to tens of millions more Americans, 150 million families having better benefits, lower cost, and no pre-existing condition, risking their access, and no lifetime limits, being a woman, no longer pre-existing condition. So that really was central because it's a health issue. It's an economic issue, a financial health issue for families, and it's a values issue for our country. So that, for me, was the highlight. The fact that it took inside-outside mobilization, as I mentioned about the LGBTQ issues, was demonstrated also at my unveiling of the portrait yesterday. Is that what you call it, unveiling? And when our guest spoke about what it meant to her to have a child with disabilities, $3 million in the first 6 months of her life for the care that she needed, but with the knowledge that all the other care that would be needed would not be subject to federal insurance company limits, and she would not be charged with a pre-existing condition. So again, what we do together, the country. We had 10,000, of which the little lobbyist, and that's what she was representing, 10,000 events in the country in support of saving the Affordable Care Act. So it was not only building up to it, passing it, but saving it. So that took a lot of my time.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly briefing today. Today is Bill of Rights Day, commemorating the ratification of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution in 1791. C-SPAN spoke to the president of the Bill of Rights Institute, David Bobb.
Bill of Rights Day is really a commemoration of the idea that, as Alexander Hamilton said, here the people rule. The Bill of Rights is really a statement about rights that individuals own. Individuals have those rights, government does not. And it marks ultimately a kind of bulwark of freedom. It's a bulwark against tyranny. So when the Americans had thrown off the king in the American Revolution, they weren't about to set up a government replacing it that would undermine or erode their rights. And so what happened is, over the series of a number of years, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution were adopted. And the Bill of Rights Day was established much later. It actually came about because on December 15th, 1791, the first 10 amendments were ratified. Virginia became the last state to ratify. And at that point, the Bill of Rights became enacted. way into the 20th century, in 1941, on December 15th, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as president, established the Bill of Rights Day.
David Bobb is president of the Bill of Rights Institute, joining C-SPAN on the Washington Journal program this morning. Originally, 12 proposed amendments to the Constitution sent to the states for ratification. One concerned the number of constituents for each representative. That was never ratified. The other does not allow the pay of members of Congress to be changed until there's an intervening election. That was adopted over 200 years later in 1992 as the 27th Amendment, and there has not been another constitutional amendment ratified in the years since. White House today taking the opportunity with the news of the death of a celebrity that's been ruled a suicide to discuss mental health resources which are available. That celebrity is Stephen Twitch Boss, a dancer who became famous on the TV show So You Think You Can Dance, and then is a DJ on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre talking about it at her briefing with reporters.
I also want to talk about something that affects millions of people across the country every day. And with the holiday season upon us, and in the light of the tragic news about Twitch this week, we think it's important that we shed light on the resources available to any American dealing with mental health challenges or emotional distress. Tomorrow, said the Second Gentleman Douglas Emhoff, and leaders from Department of Health and Human Services will visit a local 988 call center and meet with crisis counselors who are providing mental health and suicide prevention support to people from all backgrounds and walks of life. The 988 Suicide and Prevention Lifeline provides free, confidential, 24/7 support to Americans across the country experiencing suicidal crisis or severe emotional distress. Anyone, anywhere in the country can call or text 988 or chat 988lifeline.org to reach a live, trained counselor. And thanks to the president, our administration has invested $432 million in getting the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline up and running in communities across the country, an 18-fold increase in investment from the previous administration.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at the start of her briefing with reporters today in the White House briefing room. Former First Lady Michelle Obama also with a statement saying she was heartbroken by the death of Stephen Twitch Boss, remembering him as someone who radiated kindness. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.